Lecture S47, May 2, 1963, The Hamiltonian Matrix. Lecture S47, May 2nd, 1963, The Hamiltonian Matrix.
Before I begin the main topic of this lecture, I would like to describe a number of ideas, sort of mathematical ideas, which will make it easier for you to read other works on the quantum mechanics because the ideas are used so much. The first is the close mathematical resemblance between the equations of quantum mechanics and those of the scalar product of two vectors. And so I remind you first that if chi and phi are two states, the amplitude starting in phi end up in chi can be written as a sum over all I of a set of base states, the amplitude that you go from phi to one of the base states and then from the base state out again. This is, we explained in terms of a Stern-Gerlach apparatus, but of course, I must remind you that we don't need the apparatus. This is a mathematical truth that's just as true whether we put the separating equipment in or not. It's not necessary to imagine it's always there. It's simply a correct formula for this amplitude. But this I would like to compare to the dot product of two vectors, B and A. If B and A are ordinary vectors, then we can write them this dot product this way. Sum over all I of B dot EI times EI dot BA. And this is the analog of this equation in the following, with the following understanding that EI, I goes 1, 2, 3 in three dimensions, are unit vectors in the x, y, and z direction. Then b dot, a unit vector in the x direction, is what we ordinarily call b sub x, the x component. And b dot, a unit vector in the y direction, is ordinarily what we call by, and so on. So this says it's bx ax plus by ay plus bz az, which is the dot product. So this is the same thing. And the analog runs this way. A is any vector that corresponds to phi, and B is any vector corresponds to chi. The base states are special vectors which we're using to analyze things in terms of. And these are special three special vectors. And in terms of those three vectors, any other vector can be represented as a linear combination. And furthermore, if you know the three components of a vector, you know everything. And we've already pointed out. And if you know all these coefficients, then you know everything you need to know for predictions, which is the same thing. That's why a state is sometimes called a vector. Phi is sometimes called a vector. I have another equation. For instance, in the quantum mechanics, this ij is delta ij. Zero, unless I and j are equal. And one, if they're equal. Now, the dot product of the two base vectors is equal to delta ij also. It's zero if it's ex dot ey because they're at right angles. And it's one if it's ex dot ex, so it's the same. Then we have another equation underneath here, which is that chi phi complex conjugate is equal to phi chi. The analog of this equation doesn't exist in the case of vectors. The corresponding formula is that BA is equal to AB without the complex conjugate. So with one feature different, that the dot product is a product of two vectors but involves complex numbers and is slightly different than ordinary scalar product with real vectors because of this fact that we have to keep the order right or we get into trouble with complex numbers. That's why if I were to write this B dot E dot B, although it's right for vectors, it isn't right over there. It would have to have a complex conjugate. We just have to keep the order right. That's one difference, a difference, but not a very important one. Now, in vector analysis, we like to write an equation which looks, for instance, like this one. Let me write one. It's a little unusual, but I think you'll believe it. It's the sum over all I of EI multiplied by EI dot A. Now this thing means the following. If this says that any vector can be represented as a linear combination of the E sub x, E sub y, and E sub z, the coefficients being A sub x, A sub y, and A sub z respectively, right? So this is correct. The thing that's different about this, though, than the others, is that this is what we call a vector equation, while every one of the others is a relation between numbers. And one of the tricks of vector analysis is to abstract away from the equations the idea of a vector itself. And so one might be inclined to try to abstract a thing that's the analog of this over into quantum mechanics. And in fact, you can. And the way it's usually written is the following. Don't get frightened. It's just notation. It's just letters. It's marks. In a few minutes, you'll find out what they mean. In the interim, don't be afraid. We write it like this. And we could, if we wish, interpret a half of a bracket, which is often called a ket, the other one, calling the other way, is the bra of the bracket. I can't help it. That's the way it's... It's not my idea. That's the standard notation for it. At any rate, either you could call it a ket or, if you wish, a vector. And then these are vectors, and they are not numbers, these half-finished symbols. This is still a number. You can then consider this to be analog of that. Incidentally, it struck me when I was thinking about this that we have written all our equations in terms of complete numbers, and all of a sudden we want to write vectors. What did we do? Nothing. Because all vector equations could have been written without any vectors, but only with dot products. Because if I want to write F equals MA as a vector equation, if I had forced myself only to write dot products, I could have written the law B dot F equal B dot MA for any B. And then I never have to pull out a vector. It's true for any B, then it's what we call a vector equation. So in the same sense, if I have an equation which is true for any chi at all, for instance, this one is, then all I have to do is erase the chi to get this abstracted equation. So the best thing to do, if you want to, is to forget about the idea that this is a vector or something like that, and say, if you see something half written like this, that it should always be finished by multiplication of both sides by chi. It's an unfinished equation. It means that this is true no matter what chi you multiply it by. That's all it means. That means it's the same as this. As a matter of fact, this idea to take away from the equations those things which are common, which, you see, if I were to say, this equation is true for any chi and any phi, Dirac has a nice idea. Instead of having to say an equation is true for any chi and any phi, just erase those things for which it's always true. For example, we erase this, and then we get this equation. But this equation is true for any phi. Now comes a trick which has not got an analog in vector analysis, which is an invention of Dirac's, which he writes like this. And there's the great law of quantum mechanics. It means that if you put the thing, the brackets on either side, it works. And it doesn't make any difference what you put in the brackets. And that's the best way to remember the law. It's just amusing. And so, but the point is then, in the spirit of that kind of an abstraction, you could consider this as just removing one of the letters. I mean, it's just the same kind of abstraction. Or if you would like, you can consider this as a vector to represent the state, but we haven't taken a dot product into anything. Incidentally, just to remind you, to make the thing just a little bit, rewrite it in exactly the same manner, I can say that phi is a sum over all I, exactly the same, or precisely, except I'll call this C sub I, just to make sure you realize that this part's an ordinary number, and that the C sub I, in case you're interested, is I phi. Now, what we can say is, I mean, this is exactly the same as this, it's just that numbers should look more like numbers, shouldn't they? So we like it like this. Now what we can say is, you see, is that any state vector, or any state vector, any ket, can be represented as a superposition of the base kets, or base vectors, or unit vectors, corresponding to the basis, with different coefficients. We say that this coefficient CI is the amplitude that we're in the ith state when we're in phi, and that, of course, is consistent with our remark here. So the idea is that any state can be represented as a linear combination of other states, and it turns out, well, to keep going, you can show, I'll let you try to show from the consistence of all these equations, that if this is true, then the other way around can also be written. If for the same phi, well, let me put the coefficients out of the way so it's easier to see. They're the complex coefficients if you wanted to expand the bra. It's the same equation, but it's because of that when you flip it around, you take complex conjugates. So that's also true. And now the thing that's interesting is that two equations can be multiplied. That is, for instance, if I had another state, chi, which was correspondingly had expanded with other coefficients, of course. And then if I tried to find chi phi, I would just multiply this one by this one. I just multiply these two things together. In doing so, you want to be a little bit careful that the subscript on which you sum is not the same in two sums, of course. When you multiply this into this, by direct multiplication, you get the sum over, I'm only doing some practicing. I'm just practicing with the thing. You just multiply this against this and you get dj star ji, see how they lock together, times ci. You say, which way do they lock? Maybe they lock the other way. No, because you put the phi in front and the chi behind, so everything that belongs here is in this side and everything on that side. That side. Now, it happens that ij is equal to zero unless j equals I, so in this entire sum, the j sum has only one term, namely the I, and I get the remarkable formula di star ci, which is the kind of dot product. If you have two vectors and they're each expanded in the base states, then the dot product is a sub x, b sub x, plus a sub y, b sub y, plus a sub z, b sub y, and so on. The only difference is it's star. In other words, it would have corresponded to having in a theory the formula for dot product to be a sub x star bx plus a sub y star by is precise and analog, only that's not the way we did vectors because we had real vectors. But otherwise, it's the same. And furthermore, this is the same as the original formula at the top of the blackboard, as I'll let you prove. Hint, notice what ci is. It's I phi, that's this thing. And d is obviously the corresponding thing the other way for chi. And so you reproduce the top one. So we're going around in circles, but we're learning how to use the symbols. That's that. We also talked about going through a piece of apparatus. That is, if we let the particles out in a certain state phi from something, and then they had a piece of apparatus, Dan Gerlach experiments and what have you. Then they could come out the other side. We'd ask anyway with a measurement to see if they're in state chi. We would have written that chi A phi. This hasn't got any simple analog in vectors. It's closer to tensors, but it's not worthwhile making the analog. But we had several equations for this thing. We found out, for instance, that we could have break it up in different ways. For instance, this equation is right. And we also found if we put two pieces of apparatus in succession, we had an equation, which I just write without explaining because we had it one time before, that we could calculate this in terms of the effects from the two pieces of apparatus by imagining that there was a sorting machine in between. Now this again, this equation here is only an example of Dirac's fundamental rule. See, they're all examples of exactly the same rule here, that this is either a bar or a one. And so you see, when you have something like this, summed on all I, it just disappears. And that's a general principle by which you can calculate all these formulas. They're all the same formula, all the same formula here. Incidentally, another thought is possible. You could say that after the thing comes out over here, is it in some kind of a state? That is, when it was started into some kind of a condition which I can call phi, but after it comes out, could I call it, say that it's in some state psi? In other words, we could ask ourselves this question. Can we find a psi such that the amplitude to get psi to chi is always identically in every way the same as the chi a phi? And the answer is, yeah, if you look at this formula here and compare this to what it has to equal, which is sum of chi I psi, then you see that I psi, if I psi is equal to I a phi for all I, that determines psi. But it doesn't determine psi, you say. It only determines I psi. Yeah, but that determines psi. Because if you have all the coefficients, then you can define a state. So we could say that the state psi, which is what you get by going through a piece of apparatus, can be superposition like this. I a phi. It's lots of fun. You don't know what you're doing, but it's lots of fun. It all turns out to be all true equations. Incidentally, using the same notation as Dirac, we can get rid of this I, and you can make it more this way. And you can write that. And people do that. This is a new kind of a symbol that we haven't seen before. It's called a matrix, or an operator operating on a state, producing a new state. What does it mean? It means this. If you have any doubt of what something means, you just break it up using this formula to take this one backwards and forwards anytime you want, and you can just rearrange any of the formulas and make sense out of them. This is an open equation and is incomplete. It means that if I multiply this way by any chi at all, it should be right. Well, that's exactly what I wanted, wasn't it? That this is true no matter what measurement I make, no matter what chi is. I want the amplitude that after I go through the apparatus from phi to be the same as phi. Is the same thing. It's just an abstraction from this one. So on, so on. I just wanted to get you used to writing pieces of the equation instead of the full equation, because usually in the books you find pieces of the equation like that without the front ends or the back ends, and I didn't want you to be absolutely paralyzed when you looked at such a thing, because they're really quite simple ideas. Now I would like to discuss a question, which is this. We have discovered that any state in the world can be represented as a superposition with coefficients of base states. Now, first of all, what base states? Well, there's many different possibilities. You can project a spin in the z direction or in some other direction and so on. There are many, many different representations which are the analogs of different coordinate systems to represent vectors. And what coefficients? Well, that depends on the actual physical circumstance. But the important thing to know about is the space in which we're working. In other words, what these states are really like. So I will make the first question that we have to know about in general is what the base states are like. And I am going to just speak a little bit of what the future looks like. I mean, what the world looks like to us today. The problem is how to describe the basic states. Now, as I said already, there are many different representations possible. We call it a different representation when we're using a different set of states. For example, if we use the plus and minus along the z-axis for spin a hair, that's one representation of the states. And if we use the plus and minus along the x-axis, it's another representation. So I only describe one representation. To describe nature, we find that the following, in a given circumstances, the following will work, maybe. I mean, we don't know yet what the right answer is, but if we try as follows. That we can describe, for instance, a situation which you have one electron by the following, that this electron can have a spin and that has two possibilities, up or down, along the z-axis.
You say, I don't like this yet. You choose your representation. I tell you, this is one representation.
Up and down along the z-axis is one characteristic, and what momentum it has. You say, maybe it hasn't got a definite momentum.
Yes, that's all right. I'm just telling you what the base states are. If it hasn't got a definite momentum, it's got some amplitude to have one momentum, and another amplitude to have another momentum. And if it's not necessarily spinning up, it's got some amplitude to be spinning up going at this momentum, some amplitude to be spinning down going at that momentum, and so on. The complete description of an electron, as far as we know, requires only that the base states be described by the momentum and the spin, whether it's up or down along the axis. So the base states for a single electron, these things here, are values of the momentum and whether it's up or down. And the C's, the amplitude, depends upon the actual circumstance. What this electron is doing is described by telling with what amplitude it has an upspin or a downspin or a large or a small momentum and so on. But I just wanted to say what these are going to look like in the future world, you see. Now, however, we may have a system with more than one electron. Then the base states get more complicated. The base state then is described by a whole lot of, for instance, let's suppose we have two electrons. Then we have, first of all, four possible base states, both electrons spinning up, one up, one down, one up, both down. Also, we have to specify the first one has momentum P1, the second momentum P2. So we can have many, many, we have the base states require the specification of two momenta and two spin characters. So with two electrons, we specify two momenta, two spin characters. With seven electrons, then we have to specify the seven. If we have a proton and electrons, then we have to specify the spin direction of the proton and its momentum and so on, approximately. I say that and I explain it. We do not really know what the correct representations are for the world. It's all very well to start out and suppose that you specify the spin of an electron and its momentum as the basic states, and likewise for a proton, until you want to know about the inner guts of a proton. Well, let me put it slightly differently. In a hydrogen atom, which has one proton and one electron, we have many different base states to describe. Up and down spins of the proton, the electron, and the momentum of the electron and the proton. Then there's amplitudes for all different combinations, and that whole thing describes the character of the hydrogen atom. All those amplitudes that the connecting the amplitude to find them both up, both down, moving this way, moving that way, and so on. So, but that's supposed to be the base state. Now the whole darn thing is a hydrogen atom. If we didn't know that the hydrogen atom was made out of a proton and an electron, we might have started out and said, oh, I know what the base states are. You give the momentum of a hydrogen atom. No, because the hydrogen atom has internal guts, and the real nature requires a more detailed description. Now the question is, does a proton have internal guts? Do we have to describe a proton by giving it protons and mesons, or Uxel particles with mesons and wadwags with wigwigs? We don't know. And even though we suppose that the electron is simple, all we have to do is tell about the momentum of the electron and its spin, maybe tomorrow we discover that the electron has inner gears and wheels. What we mean is that our representation is incomplete or wrong or approximate. In the same way as a representation of the hydrogen atom, which described only its momentum, would be incomplete because it disregarded and did not appreciate the fact that the hydrogen atom could have become excited inside. So if an electron could become excited inside and turn into something else, like a mu meson or something, then that would be described not by two new particles, by a new particle, but should be described presumably by some more complicated internal wheels. We therefore today have one main problem, is to discover what the representations are for nature. At the present time, we guess that the electron has to have its momentum and spin specified, that there's an idealized proton which has it, mesons which have, K mesons have to be specified, their momentum, so on, so on, so on, 61 particles, that's crazy. So the question of what's a fundamental particle and what's not a fundamental particle, which you hear so much talk about, is the question of whether in the ultimate description of the quantum mechanical world, what the final representation is going to look like. Will the electron's momentum still be the right thing to describe nature with? And furthermore, of course, whether that has any sense is another question. Whether the whole question has sense is a typical lovely characteristic of scientific investigation. At any rate, we see a problem, how to find a representation. We don't know the answer. We don't even know whether a thing means something, but if it does, that's the problem of whether a particle is fundamental or not. In the non-relativistic quantum mechanics, if the energies are not too high, you don't have to disturb the inner guts of the strange particles and so forth, they can do a pretty good job of without worrying about these details. You could say, yeah, you specify the momentum and position of the electrons and of the nuclei, and everything will be all right, because in most chemical reactions, low-energy things, what goes on in the nuclei is nothing happens. They don't get excited. And furthermore, even in a situation in which, for instance, the hydrogen atom is moving slowly and bumping quietly against other hydrogen atoms, never getting excited inside, by excited and radiating or anything complicated like that, but always in the ground state of energy, internal motion, for internal motion, then there's an approximation available in which you talk about the hydrogen atom as one object and don't worry about the fact that it can do something inside. And we will be making a large number of those kind of approximations in which we will not discuss sometimes inner motion possibilities that decreases the number of details that we have to have in our base states, and then of course omits some phenomena which usually appear at some higher energy. But I would like to explain ahead that we can make such approximations and simplify very much the analysis of physical problems, that we can discuss the collision of two hydrogen atoms at low energy, for instance, without worrying about the fact that they can be excited. That isn't quite true of hydrogen atoms, but let's say that the nucleus can be excited, can be disregarded for many chemical processes. Well, that's one problem, how to represent nature, what the states are. That's not all we need to know. Even if we knew all the states, we still have to know what happens. I mean, if you give me the CI at a given moment, that tells me what condition the world is in. I want to know what the condition is later. And so we also have to find the laws that determine how things change in time. So we now address ourselves to the second part of the framework of quantum mechanics. The first is the states, and the next is how do states change in time. And I would like to discuss that next. We have already talked about what happens if we put, how we can represent, rather, a situation in which we put something through an apparatus. Now, one convenient, delightful apparatus to consider is merely wait a few minutes. That is, you let the state out over here, phi, and then before you analyze, just let it sit there. Or there may be things turned on and off. It depends on the physical circumstances in the world. But at any rate, whatever the conditions are, you let it sit from time t1 to t2. You see, suppose that it's let out in the condition phi at t1. See, I'm already writing half equations. And then it goes through an apparatus, but the apparatus consists of just delay until t2. Well, of course, while it's delay, I don't know what's going on. I mean, what external forces there are or what internal shenanigans are going on to the thing, but something can be happening. And when I'm all finished then, the amplitude to find the thing in state chi is no longer exactly the same as it was if I didn't have a delay, but it's different. And so we have, it's like an apparatus, and instead of calling it A, I call it U, and I'll put the two times in here. And this is an important thing, this U. Of course, like any other matrix, it can be represented in a base system of some sort by giving chi I U T 2 minus T1 T2 T1 J J phi. So if someone asked me, what do I mean? How do I give the U? I would say I give this whole set of coefficients for some base system. Incidentally, for most of the high-class, high-energy work that the modern theoretical physicist does, he considers problems of the following general nature, because this is the way the experiments are usually done. Something's coming in from infinity, a couple of particles maybe one standing still, say, and another is coming from a machine that's practically at infinity from the atomic level. And the thing goes crash, the things fly, hit together like a proton hits another proton. And out comes six pions in certain directions and so on. And under those circumstances, the mathematics would look like this. That the phi state would specify the spin and momentum of one of the target and of the hitting particle. The chi would be a question, like, you know, with what amplitude you get five pions going in such and such and such direction and two nucleons and so on. So the chi would be specified by giving the momenta of all the particles and the spins and so on. Also, yes, including positrons and antineutrons and whatnot. And then you'd have to calculate this thing. However, the special case that would be interesting would be when T1 is essentially back at minus infinity and T2 is at plus infinity. We're not interested in the detail at any instant. We're only interested before and after. And so, this is just for your own information in case you've ever heard the word. The limit of this thing as T1 goes to minus infinity and T2 goes to plus infinity, which we would write as chi times, the limit of the U is called S usually. And then we would calculate chi s phi, or in this form, in general, I s j. This s is merely the limiting case for long intervals of time, and is often called the s matrix. And you hear theoretical physicists pacing the floor and saying, all I have to do is to calculate the s matrix. Yeah, that's all. That's all it is. Anyway, that's what the s matrix is. It's just the collision matrix, so-called, between the incoming and outgoing state in the limiting case when the things have come from infinity and go off to infinity. I just want you to get some words in case you happen to read anything, because you get frightened of words if you haven't heard them, that's all. However, now, how to analyze and how to specify the laws for the S matrix is an interesting question. In relativistic quantum mechanics with high energy and so on, it's done one way. But in non-relativistic quantum mechanics, it can be done another way, which is very convenient. This other way can also be done in relativistic case, but under those circumstances, it's not so convenient. And that is to divide this S into intervals of time, just to watch how things go as a function of time. You can appreciate immediately that's not so hot for relativity, because you don't want to have to specify how everything looks simultaneously all over and so on. But if you don't worry about that, but worry about, we're just going to apply this to non-relativistic mechanics, then we can analyze the U in the following way. First of all, suppose that I were to delay an interval T3 from T1, which is, can be thought of as greater than the T2. In other words, let's take three times. So it's the T1 is less than T2 is less than T3. Then I claim that the matrix that goes between T1 and T3 for the total interval is the product in succession of what happens when you delay for one interval times the other in the sense of the matrix product BA written up there. I'll let you prove that to yourself in one way or another. It's just an interesting thing. So that means, of course, that we can analyze any time interval if we can analyze some short time interval and just multiply it all together. And that's the way that the quantum mechanics is analyzed non-relativistically. What we do is we analyze this question for infinitesimal time interval. We ask ourselves merely this. If you have a state phi now, what does a state look like for infinitesimal time later? So let's see how we write that out. We have a call the state at the time t, psi at t, to be perfectly clear. Then that's the condition at the time t. Now the condition at the time, if we ask a question after a small interval of time between t plus delta t and t, then this is the answer. For if we ask any question at all. And in the same sense that what we have said before, I would say that this answer is also the same as the amplitude defined chi from the state psi at the time t plus delta t. That defines this, and you see what it is. It says that psi of t plus delta t is just the u for the time interval times psi of t. Nice abstract hocus pocus. Same idea. But I think we're not too good at this abstract thing, so I'm going to project it into a definite representation. So if I multiply both sides of this by I, I get I psi at t plus delta t is equal to I times u at t plus delta t, t. And just to save, I want to do something, so I'll just do it right now. Certainly this equation is right. If I call this I of psi of t, the amplitude to be in the base state I at the time t, you see, you can think of it as varying with the time t. Then this equation is a fancy equation for this, that c of t plus delta t is a whole lot of coefficients, this funny u business, with a lot of coefficients, ij, where this is nothing but the same symbol written over again to make it look easier, multiplied by cj of t. And that's the way the quantum mechanics is going to look. But we haven't got too far yet, except one thing. Certainly, if delta t goes to zero, what is the u going to become? Suppose I don't weigh at all. Then there should be a 1 in here. That is, if I don't weigh at all, I should get back the original thing. In short, the u, ij, for the small interval delta t, should equal delta ij for the zero interval. It would be 1, in other words, if there's no interval. And it will differ from 1 by an amount proportional to delta t. So we write something times delta t. Now, why we write minus I over h times capital H ij is because it doesn't make any difference. I mean, it's a bunch of coefficients. It's proportional to delta t. Why I call the coefficient minus I over h times capital H instead of just F for my own name is that it was invented by somebody else earlier, and it happened to be invented in a way that these parts of the constant were taken out. But you appreciate all I'm saying is that u differs from 1 by an amount proportional to delta t. That's all I'm saying. So if I suppose that u differs from 1 by an amount proportional to delta t, and that's just the definition then of h. H is the measure of how much u, is really a measure of how things change, because it tells us what a u looks like for an infinitesimal time. It tells how it differs from 1, which is the only interest. Now, if I put delta ij in here, of course I get ci of t, and then I get minus I over h times delta t times the sum over all j of hij cj sub t. So just guessing, therefore, that the u will differ in first order in time interval, we obtain the following form that quantum mechanics is going to take. That if the state at any time wishes to be analyzed as a superposition in terms of, this is the final law now, as a superposition of base states, keeping the base states always fixed. I'm not letting them change. There are ways, case people who change those too, but let's leave this alone now. Otherwise, you're using a rotating coordinate system. And let ci of t be the coefficients, which tells how much of each state there is in the state, psi of t. These coefficients change with time, and that's going to tell the dynamics of the world. It's going to describe the fact that I'm waving my arms. That c is changing with time. If you want, by the same, the c is, of course, in the other notation. I just go back and forth with notations so that you don't get... I could leave it all in one, but I want you to feel when a thing is a number sometimes, that it's just a number and there's nothing scary and so on. This is a definition of the c's, and is enough to tell the behavior of the world. We only need the differential equation, which we obtained from here from small delta t. The difference of these two is delta t times the derivative. And taking the I and the H on the other side, because it's more conventional to do that, we get dI dt is equal to a sum over all j over the whole set of base states of a set of coefficients,
hij times cj of t. The hij in general may depend themselves on t. And if you know the hij, then voila! Yeah, I mean, voila. You got everything. See? If you know what these h's are, then you can describe the behavior of the quantum mechanical system as a function of time and ask any kinds of questions about it. And herein lies the great equation that meaningless because we don't know what the hij's are. Therefore, the machine, the physics supplies also some rules for determining the hij. And we have problems with that too in the strong, in the new particles. In fact, that's the hardest part of the thing. Of course, a part of the difficulty is how you can specify the hij until you made up your mind what the base states are. I don't know. I mean, in the new world that we're working on now, so we don't know what the h is in general for the whole world. But we have excellent approximations in non-relativistic phenomena, for example, plus other cases. We have lots of good approximate forms, particularly for non-relativistic motion of electrons around nuclei for atoms and chemistry and so on. So that we do know a lot about the H for practical purposes, although we don't know the full true H of the whole universe. There are many other ways that this equation can be written. In order to, I will just say one thing, that it's convenient to define this thing by identically, so that this is hji, so that you can use Dirac's notation. And then if you would like to, you can try to prove that this equation can be written in the following form, just to see if you understand all the notation, just for fun. But all you really have to understand is this much that's in this square here. But if you'd like to play with the high-class form of way people write things on, in an obscure way, this equation is equivalent to this one. You play around and see if you can see that. But this is all we have here. And now we'd like to discuss the consequences. First of all, and easiest of all, well, this hij, by the way, is a matrix and is called, for peculiar historical reasons, the Hamiltonian matrix. Hamilton worked in 1830, and how he got his name on the quantum mechanical matrix is a tale of history. But it's called the Hamiltonian matrix. It would be much better called the energy matrix, for reasons that will come apparent as we work with it. It's related to energy better than, that's what it is, but it's called the Hamiltonian. The Hamiltonian or the Hamiltonian matrix. So the problem is to know your Hamiltonian, eh? Okay. Now, we take a case, situation, that the physical circumstances aren't changing with time. That is the external physical conditions. That's H is independent of time. Nobody's turning on and off magnets. Case one, H is independent of time. Case two, there's only one base state required to describe the system. It's an approximation where you say it's like a hydrogen atom at rest or something, and there's no spin or something. So there's no base state, there's only one base state. What then? Then the equation says dc sub 1 dt is equal to h1 1 c1, and that's all. And if h is constant, this differential equation is easily solved, and it says that C1 is a constant times e to the minus I over h times h11t. And that's why, that's like the energy. It says the thing has a definite energy. H11 is the energy. So then there's only one state, then h is the energy. See, that's why hij ought to be called the energy matrix. It's the generalization of the energy for the most complex situation. Done. Now we do two states. To understand what the equation means, suppose we have a system which has two base states. Then the equation reads dc sub 1 dt is equal to h11 c1 plus h12 c2, and ih times dc2 dt is equal to h21 c1 plus h22 c2. Those are all there is to it. Now, if the H's are independent of time, you can solve these equations. We leave you to try for fun. We'll come back and do them later. But you see, you already can do it. So if the H's are independent of time, you can actually solve these. You can solve quantum mechanics without knowing the H's, as long as they're independent of time. Now, there is one thing I forgot to mention. In that Hij and H star Ji are equal. This is a condition that the total probability of firing a particle in any state doesn't change. That if you've got the particle and as time goes on, you still got the particle, or the objects, or the world. So you try to prove that this is that if this is true, then the Ci of t absolute square summed over all I, which is the total probability of finding it somewhere, stays constant. But let's suppose I forgot to do that, and I want to do something more. I want to kind of finish this off a little bit. Now, here we have a situation in which we do not know the H's, but we're not interested. We can't do anything until we know the H's. I am now going to describe a physical circumstance in which we know that, which we can guess at the H. Just as an example, only as an example, so as to make the thing more realistic. Of course, we can use a spin a half particle, but we'd use the same thing too many times. Let's try something else. I'm going to take a situation which is the ammonia molecule. The ammonia molecule is a nitrogen atom with three hydrogen atoms in a plane below the nitrogen in a form of a pyramid. It's not in the plane of the hydrogens, but it's off the plane of the hydrogen. Now, this molecule has an infinite number of states. It can spin around this axis, it can spin around that axis, it can be translating and moving in all directions, it can be vibrating inside, and so on and so on. And therefore, it is not a two-state system at all. But please allow me to make an approximation that I keep all other states fixed, because for what I want to discuss now, I can. If the thing is, say, spinning around this axis, that determines an axis, it's spinning around this axis, and let's suppose that it has zero translational momentum, and let's suppose that it's vibrating as little as possible. That specifies all conditions except one. It's spinning around this way. That is, the same molecule could be this way. Hydrogen's on this side, upside down. That's the only thing. And I'm going to discuss this thing as though it were a two-state system. That is, the only two states I'm going to really be worrying about, all other things being equal. So it's spinning a certain angular momentum around the NH3 axis, and it's moving with zero momentum and so on, it's vibrating in a definite way, but it still haven't told you whether it's this one or this one. So state number one will be this state, and state number two will be that state. Now, in fact, at any moment, it can be, the actual state can be represented by giving a coefficient to be in state 1 plus another coefficient to be in state 2. Now we would like to write down the formula for the Hamiltonian equation and so on. And here is what we would write, the same as we wrote up there. Exactly, of course. You see, you say, I don't know which it's in. Well, all right, you got an amplitude to be in both, and that amplitude may change with time and so on. Suppose, for example, you made an observation somehow, or you made a selection, so you know it's in this condition. How long does it take to get into that condition? Such a question. Well, we have to solve the differential equations to find the amplitudes as a function of time, and here they are. dC1 dt is equal. Now, if it weren't for the existence of the other state, H11 would be the energy. So let's call E naught the energy that we would calculate for this state if we had not any other knowledge about the other state. Then this is the way the equations would look. And these are easy to solve. They get separated. And then all it means is that if it's in the first one, it stays in the first one. If it's in the second one, it stays in the second one. But that's not what ammonia really does. It turns out that it's possible for the ammonia, for the nitrogen, to push its way through the three hydrogens and flip over. It's quite difficult. On the way through, it's got much more energy, if you would stop it and look at it, than it has. And you say, how can it get through if it hasn't got enough energy? The same way as light goes through when it's above the index of refraction, through the gap, It's penetration through a barrier. It's possible in quantum mechanics to sneak across a region which is illegal energetically for a moment. And there's a certain amplitude then that C2 builds up because it's in C1 and goes poof, through the middle. So there's a certain amplitude. Now, I have no way to know at this point whether this is real or imaginary or what the sign is. I happen to know that it's negative real, but it doesn't make any difference, as you'll see, what it is. It's anything you can put here. But obviously, from the symmetry of the thing, it's the same thing over here, or more precisely, because of that condition HIJ equals HJI star, what goes here is generally the complex conjugate of that. But let me take the case minus A. Now, this then are the pair of equations that we have to solve to find the motion. And they're simple enough that the time is running short that I'll solve them at enormous velocity. First of all, if you add the two equations, you get a lot of stuff times the rate of change with respect to time of the sum of the two of the things is equal to E minus A times the sum, right? Okay? Add. Therefore, the answer is that C1 plus C2 is equal to E to the minus I over H times E minus A times T1, times a constant. And in the same way, by subtracting the equations, you can prove that the difference between the two, the difference by subtracting the equation, comes out to E plus A times T times B, as you can see from fiddling around. Therefore, if I add these two things together, I get the solution. C1 of T is equal to A over 2 times E to the minus I over H times E minus A. I'm sorry I have to go through it so quickly, but I'm sure you'll find when you look at it that you too can do it. B over 2 times E. See, the trouble with quantum mechanics is not solving the equations, but not understanding what they mean. And the C2 of T is the same thing here with a minus sign. Now we can ask and answer all kinds of questions. First of all, I'd like to give a special interpretation, a couple of remarks. If B is equal to 0, this is a general solution, any A and B, depends on the initial conditions. If B is equal to 0, then all the amplitudes, not only the two of them, both have the same frequency. Everything changes at the same frequency, both amplitudes, and that's a state of definite energy. So the ammonia molecule can have a state of definite energy only if it's in both, has an equal amplitude to be in both. If it has an equal amplitude to be in both, then the energy of the molecule is E minus A. But the energy of the molecule can be another value, because if A is equal to 0, then we have another solution in which both C's oscillate at the same frequency. That's a steady state of definite energy. And that energy is E naught plus A. And in that case, the two amplitudes are equal and opposite. So there are two states, which I'll discuss a little more next time, of two different energies. And because of this ability to flip through, therefore, the molecule has every one of its levels doubled. By I mean every one, because I told you I picked out a special spinning and so on. Well, after I picked that out, it's still double, because of the flip-flap through the hydrogens. Now we ask one more question, and I'll be finished. Suppose that at time t equals 0, I know that I got it in the state number 1. How do I find the probability of being in state 2, or in 1, at time t? Well, this gives the formula for the amplitudes at any time. But the specification that at t equals 0, he knows that it's in number 1, is that C1 of 0 is equal to 1, and that C2 of 0 is equal to 0. Well, that's just the standard business for solving equations. We always have the same stuff in the physics. You put t equals 0, all these exponentials are 1, and you say that C2 must be 0. That means, therefore, that A must equal B. And if you look at C1 with A and B equal and make C1 1, you find they must both be 1. So the initial conditions specify that A and B are both 1. Then the equation is easy to find. Now all we need is the absolute value of this thing with A and B each equal to 1. For instance, let me find the probability that it's still in the number 1 condition. That will be C1 absolute square. And all I have to do is to consider that C1, let me just do a little factoring, is e to the minus I e naught t times 1/2 e to the I over h a t plus 1/2 e to the minus I over h a t. You see, we're looking here with 1/2 for each. Oh, there's an h here. Now if we take C1 square, we find the absolute square of this is 1, and this thing is automatically just cosine a t over h. So the probability of being in number 1 state goes as cosine squared a t over h. And the probability of being in number 2 state, since there's a minus sign in there, you figure it out, is sine squared. Also, you can tell because the probability, total probability, doesn't change. That means that as a function of time, the situation looks like this. The probability of being in the first state doesn't stay. It goes and it dumps itself into the second state. Then it's 100% in the second state. Then it comes back and gets into the first state and so on. Some long time ago, we had two pendula which had a slight coupling. And when you lift one back and let go, then it swings. And gradually, the other starts to swing. And pretty soon, the other has picked up all the energy. And then it swings back again. And then the other one picks up the energy. It's exactly the same kind of a thing. The speed at which it does it depends on the coupling between the two, the rate at which it's able to leak. Also, you remember with the two pendula, there were two special motions which had a definite frequency, which we call the fundamental mode. If we pull them both out together, the two pendulums work together at one frequency. But if we pull one out one way and the other out the other way, then there was another mode at a definite frequency. Well, here they are, all represented all over again, the same pair of pendula. Here are the two frequencies for pulling them out together, pulling them out opposite. If you pull only one out, then you get a superposition of these two frequencies, and you get a time-dependent phenomenon, because you're not in one or the other definite frequency, i.e. definite energy, because frequency and energy are the same in quantum mechanics. So there's an example at long last of a physical problem that you can understand, I hope. Thank you very much. All right.
Is this I imaginary, or is that I
this
right?
Which I?
That's
an I imaginary. I'm sorry. That's too bad, but I shouldn't have used I for states. It's imaginary. Yes, sir.
What is the
E-naught? Well, E-naught is energy, is something that you would calculate if you forgot about the fact that it could flip back and forth. It's some constant, which disregards the fact that it can go through.
Is that just the energy of the state that it's in?
It's the energy it would be if it couldn't flip. I mean, it's the beginning of an analysis. It's a partial approximation. You forget the other phenomenon, then you'd say it's E naught. Well, how to calculate the E and the A is something we are, of course, not able to do here at this point. We don't know the energy of the nitrogen ammonia molecule or anything. We don't know how to calculate the rate it will flip through. So I call them letters. Certainly there's some E, and it's the same here. It's like the energy of the molecule in an approximation in which somebody forgot to notice that it can flip through. Because the actual energy of the molecule is neither, is not even there. It's either this or that. There are two states. Well, this is just the elements of the Hamiltonian. This E naught is H11, and it also happens in our problem to be H22, and minus A is H12, is equal to H21 in this problem. This is a special case. It's a special case for which I have a way of arguing by which I know something about the A. All I really am doing is taking a situation that's symmetrical. In a situation that's symmetrical, H11 and H22 are evidently equal, call it E0. H12 and H21 are necessarily equal in complex conjugates. It doesn't make any difference if you change some phase somewhere.
and I call it minus A. And so I solve that problem, but I want to make a realistic example.
Well, here. It's okay. Just drop off the two.
It's a special case where the two states have some kind of symmetry so that that these two are equal. You see, in here it'll be the same energy as in here. And the leakage amplitude will be the same because of the symmetry of the system. Nothing. It's just a set of coefficients for the change, how the amplitudes change. That's all. And it has to do with energy.
That's what I wanted.
Yeah, but you can't just call it classical energy.
The energy, no. But
no, it isn't the energy, no. But it's something like the energy, sort of. For instance, if you could shut off the leakage, you know it would be the energy. But the leakage rate is not an energy any directly. It's got the dimensions of energy. But it's very hard to understand it as an energy because it's between two different states. It's a rate at which amplitudes leak from one condition to another.
Will you argue again why the nitrogen can go, you can see there's some possibility.
Right, but the nitrogen can go through the three hydrogens is a priori impossible because it takes too much work to push them apart. Yeah. But in quantum mechanics, if two things are close enough together, like the position of nitrogen here or here, I'm not worried about the center of gravity moving. You have to have the center of gravity fixed. You understand? That's not, I don't know if I drew it all right. Yeah. Both the hydrogens and the nitrogen. Mostly the hydrogen moves for the center of gravity. But that's a small point. That's not what we're worried about now, right? If two things are close together, like the position of the hydrogen on one side or the other, even though there's a barrier of energy against it, even though in the intermediate condition it could stay there because it hasn't got enough energy, it has some amplitude to get through. Yeah. That's A.
That's small.
Much smaller than E naught. Very small. Yes, in fact, very small. As a matter of fact, the difference in energy that we have obtained here, 2A, for these two, is very, very small compared to the energies of vibrations and even rotations. And is why the ammonia molecule is interesting, because most molecules don't have such a thing so far in the infrared. You see, here are two states, which we'll learn in a little while. Well, you can see that there's a dipole moment between anyway. It's like an oscillation. And you can drive it from one to the other with electric fields and so on. It emits light in going from one to the other. But it's unusually close together. Atoms emit optical light because it's an electron which moves like lightning. Molecules in vibrating emit in the infrared, the ordinary infrared. In rotating, which is easier, they emit in the far infrared. But this thing is in the microwave region. This frequency difference is so low that it's in the microwave region. And for the case of phosphine, which is pH 3, I think it comes out 7 minutes or something for the time it takes to do this flip-flop, and that the difference in energy that corresponds to is a wavelength, 7 minutes long. 7 light minutes long. So you see, it's just luck that it works at all. Because it's hard for the phosphorus to penetrate, but it's easier for the nitrogen. Yeah. It's a small effect. Yeah, A is small.
Yeah,
they measure this.
Yeah, they measure. And they measure the
A.
What do you call it?
The
light.
Yes.
As well.
The microwaves.
Right.
Right.
And that's what they use to get A.
That's right. That's
now
how we measure A.
No,
you can make an estimate of A by calculating, but it's too complicated. Nobody else really knows how to calculate the A. There are other problems. Well, there are other problems for which the H's can be calculated from a deeper understanding. You see, you could start out and describe this whole goddamn thing by telling about the nucleus, the electrons, and all the other nuclei. And say you have a representation with millions and millions of states giving the momentum of each of the 10 electrons and the 4 nuclei. And then try to solve the equations, you see. It's possible to write down the Hamiltonian. We know what it is. But we can't solve it. Now, when we take another case, we'll do another case later, which is the hydrogen molecular ion, in which we have two protons and an electron, which either sits near one or near the other. And we'll do that, it's exactly the same problem. The electron, if you have two plus charges, it's here or here, it's the same form, same answer, same thing. Only there, we really can do a much better job in the complete theory, because there, if we hold the nuclei fixed, we only have one electron, and then its representation with this momentum is not too hard. So we can solve that exactly, and then you can really calculate the A and you know it. And then by some sort of law, by gradually developing some intuitions, you can make estimates of how big the A and E naughts and so on ought to be. But in a complicated thing as an ammonia molecule, you're not able to calculate it. I believe that the 7 minutes for the pH 3 is estimated rather than calculated. It's never been measured, I don't think.
You said the business of understanding elementary particles was involved with understanding the base states or something.
Well, two things. First, we have to know what are the base states of the world. Would it be enough to specify the position of all the electrons, positrons, and their spin? No, because we have protons. And protons? Well, are protons compound, or are they made of something else?
Yeah. Yeah.
So should we specify the protons, or should we specify the mesons and ux-woggles that they're made out of? So we don't know. That's one problem. And the other problem was, even if we do know, I mean, it's connected, what the Hamiltonian is, what the H's are. That's what we don't know.
There's some theory that all particles are composite particles of other particles.
Yes, that's an attempt to try to change the method of description of the quantum mechanics, a little bit away from what we've been doing, with the hope to get some kind of a way of talking. So you don't have to make up your mind, which is whether the states that you've got are fundamental in your representation. So we could use, we could try to use a hydrogen atom as one of the descriptive states and its momentum. But then we have to talk about excited hydrogen atoms, there's still something else and so on. Well, there's an attempt to try to show that there might be some way of writing the world down so you don't have to say ahead of time what the basic states are. It's interesting possibility. These are very high-class theoretical questions about which we don't know the answer, but that's what they're talking about.
Would that be analogous? I mean, when you describe something in ordinary three-dimensional coordinates,
to try to do it out
there's no particular one.
No axes, you mean. Yeah, that's
no
right.
Special axes.
That's right. It's something like
where
that.
Where this composite particle theory comes from?
It's something like that, except it's more like not knowing the number of dimensions. Without having to decide on the space at all.
It doesn't come from that there's no particular axes.
It's close to, there's no particular axes, we already know that you can use more than one, but we at least know that some set of axes works. It's as though you had a situation where you never knew, because you don't know the space well enough, that these could be axes, these could be axes. See, that you can't, you don't know any set that they could be, is the situation. No set for sure that they could be. That's the problem. Can you still do the physics then, you see, if you don't know for sure any set that it could be? That's the problem of writing it without saying what the fundamental particles are.
What's Skelman's theory, the one with the octets that predicted the prime meson?
That has a piece of the information on the Hamiltonian and the representations. That's when I was discussing for it, this is not a very good example, but in the right direction. I could specify the momentum of an electron and its spin, I mean up and down, right? Now I also have positrons. I could specify their momentum and their spin too. But I have a new way I could do electrons and positrons. I could specify a thing, which, what do we call it, a charge, an electro, okay? Which is either an electron or a positron. Now you have two things. You specify the momentum, the spin, and C, the charge. If it's positive, you're talking about an electron. If it's minus, you're talking about a positron. All right? That makes the electron and positrons different aspects of the same thing. All right? Okay. That's the idea. Now, for particle or antiparticle, that's definitely done. I didn't say it in the lecture, but that is done. That's really right. For neutron and proton, that's attempted, because they're very similar. It's tried to make a system in which one is one and the other is another, or two aspects of the same object. Two qualities, like spin, only its quality, like charge. Neutron, it's called a nucleon, which is either neutron condition or proton condition. That was the original idea. Now when he finds all these particles, we have neutron, proton, sigmas, lambdas, xis, and so on, and also a set of pi's, mesons, and another set of resonance mesons, and whatnot. And he tried this idea that the eight particles, neutron, proton, xi plus and minus, three sigmas and a lambda, are to be specified ultimately in the last world, in the ultimate world, by giving the momentum of it, the spin of it, and then one of a set of numbers that tells you which kind of a thing it is. In other words, they really belong together. And then there's a lot of discussion of symmetry and make a thing neat, because that alone doesn't say anything, because I could tie an electron to a proton artificially. I mean, I could just do it artificially, but the thing is that that's have some symmetry. And so the pattern of eightness is carried over to other particles, you see, like the mesons and so on, and you get some kind of understanding of what you should expect when something looks like it's missing over here, because this is analogous to this, and so on. It's an interesting...
Yeah, I tried to read about it, and something that scared me was a vector meson.
A vector meson. Vector means spin one. And the meson is a particle.
So it's not... It's
spin one particle.
Spin one particle.
Yeah. Yeah, of course. That's why I put a few words in from time to time, although it may confuse a little when I say things like, you know, I write a few other little equations so that you won't get scared by the words, because that's all they are. They're just other words for the same thing sometimes.
What a conspiracy that, you know.
No, you can see why. It has three components. The base state, the three base states, just like the three components of the electron. That's why.
And if it were a spin a half